Right then, brethren, we said last week, as we returned to the topic of prophecy, that Jesus gave us quite a number of warnings about the need to be watchful, to remain alert, and to look out for the signs of the times. He criticized the Pharisees for not being alert to the signs of the times. Jesus said things like, when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, and you have to be obviously looking out for that to see it. Jesus said, when you see all these things come to pass, know the end is near. Well, again, are we looking? Do we know what to look for? So Jesus made it quite plain that we should be alert and watchful, you know, to a degree. There are, I think, a number of people that believe that prophecy and studying prophecy is just a distraction. You should concentrate on living right. Well, we certainly should. But it's probably wise to pay some attention to prophecy since Jesus told us to and warned us to take heed that he told us beforehand things that would come to pass. If we ignore those, it's our loss. So what we're doing at the moment is reviewing much of the material that we covered in some depth earlier in the year, particularly looking at the prophecies found in Daniel and the book of Revelation. And we've said, I'm sure many, many, many times now, that we can all endeavour to be at least familiar with the biblical narrative. In other words, what it just says. What does it contain? The narrative itself. However, when we come to interpret what it might actually mean, that can be a wee bit more tricky. We do see through a glass darkly. It's inevitable. There's a little bit of speculation here and there, but let's try to be responsible as we interpret the prophecies, but let's be familiar with what the words themselves actually say, the narrative. Now, last week, we spent quite a bit of time in Daniel chapter 2. We're not going back there today, you'll be pleased to hear. But chapter 2 of Daniel described this great statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw in a dream, head of gold, chest of silver, and so on. And most people are fairly agreed on the gold, the silver, and the bronze. But when you get to the fourth kingdom, the kingdom of the iron legs, there's certainly two ideas. The most popular majority view is that the fourth empire of Daniel 2 represents the Roman Empire. The iron legs represent the Roman Empire. Now, that's been a very popular view for quite a long time. It looks like a writer by the name of Hippolytus conjured up that view about 200 AD in his commentary on the book of Daniel. And, you know, for, I guess that makes it about 1800 years now, the most common view, the normal view is, that fourth empire, the one of iron, is indeed the Roman Empire. But we should remember that the angel did say to Daniel that he should seal up his prophecies, that they were sealed until the time of the end. So any interpretation of Daniel, which comes from 200 AD, or even, say, Sir Isaac Newton, unlikely to be accurate, because the meaning could only be revealed or unsealed at the end time. Now, we saw last week that if we examine closely the prophecy of Daniel 2 and the iron legs, Rome doesn't seem to fit very well. You may recollect that the fourth empire is prophesied to crush, smash, pulverize all the others. To crush and pulverize Babylon, Persia, let's say Greece for now. Well, the catch is that Rome didn't do that. It never defeated Persia at all. although it defeated the Greek Empire, it didn't exactly smash them. It quite appreciated Greek culture and architecture and religion and absorbed much of it. So, you know, Rome doesn't really fit the biblical narrative. However, we said, if you look at the Islamic empires, now they do rather fit much better, beginning in the 600s. In fact, right up to today, the Islamic Empire has crushed, pulverized, and smashed wherever it's been. Today, the nations of Babylon, Persia, Javan, as it is in the Hebrew, the former Greek Empire, are all Islamic countries, as indeed is much of southern Russia, North Africa, Saudi Arabia, Middle East countries. Islamic Empire has conquered a huge portion of the world. And they reckon that Islamic wars over the last 1400 years have killed approximately, give or take a bit, 270 million people. Crushing, pulverizing, and smashing. And in fact, of course, they're still fighting and killing today. You can think of Syria. Best estimates are that in the last 5 years, something like 300,000 to 400,000 have died. I guess nobody knows for sure. And something like 5 million or maybe 6 million refugees have fled Syria and now live in, you know, temporary camps. So I've suggested that the Islamic Empire looks like a much stronger candidate than Rome. Or, of course, when we say Rome, people typically mean Western Europe. And usually they mean a German-led Nazi-type, you know, Germany leading Western Europe, somehow derived from, you know, the Roman Empire. So I've suggested that perhaps it's a good idea if we pay perhaps some watchful attention to the Middle East, to the Middle East countries, especially the Islamic ones, because I believe it's much more likely that they will feature predominantly in the end times than perhaps Germany and Western Europe. Now, I'm not exactly sure what will be the next thing to happen prophetically. That will be of great interest to us. But Daniel chapter 8, and we will turn there, Daniel chapter 8 suggests we should be watching in particular Iran and Turkey. So let's turn to Daniel 8. Quick recap over last week's comments. We'll start in Daniel 8, verses 15 to 19. Because Daniel 8 is the prophecy of the ram and the he-goat, the shaggy goat, the male goat. But let's pick up verses 15 through 19. Now it happened that when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, because he wanted to understand it as well, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of the river Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, and we know who he is, Gabriel the angel, that came to Mary and Elizabeth and so on. Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision of the he-goat and the ram refers to the time of the end. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright. He said, look, I'm making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. Well, the New American says, at the appointed time of the end. So here it tells in verse 17, the vision refers to the time of the end. And again, verse 19, the latter time, the appointed time of the end. That's fairly sort of plain. And yet, you know, most commentators say this related to, you know, Alexander the Great and Persia of long ago. But the angel says it's the time of the end. At least twice, nearly three times there. Look at verse 26. The angel continues, and the vision of the evenings and mornings, a few verses earlier, which was told is true. Therefore, seal up the vision. Seal it up. It's not for now. And in fact, it wasn't for 100 years later or 200 years later. It's for the end time. He says, therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. So the vision that we're reading here isn't historic. It is prophetic for the end time. Now, who does the vision relate to? Look at Daniel 8, verses 20 to 21. The ram, which you saw, having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. Well, today we call Persia Iran. You know, when I was growing up, it was still called Persia. You had the Shah of Persia. It was very much pro-Western, but he got kicked out, and now we call it Iran. But that's the ram of the prophecy. Represents or pictures what we call today Iran, or I guess in America usually is Iran. Okay, verse 21, and the male goat, the he-goat, the shaggy goat, is, it says, the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that's between its eyes is its first king or premier king. And it says Greece, but the Hebrew word there is Javan or Yavan, which is a region sort of around the Aegean Sea. It does include what today we call Greece, although that country wasn't established back in Daniel's day, but also includes other countries around, and in particular, of interest to us, Western Asia Minor, or today we call it Turkey. And Turkey appears to be the predominant part of Javan in these end times. So we're looking at a prophecy of Iran and mostly Turkey. So what actually is going to take place? Let's drop back to verses 3 to 4, Daniel 8, 3 to 4. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. The high one came up last. I guess all of this is significant. Two horns. And of course, horns typically represent an authority, a power. Perhaps a ruler or a king. So there's two of them attached to the ram. One comes up later, but becomes ultimately bigger and stronger. Verse 4, I saw the ram, or let's put in the word Iran. I saw Iran pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no beast, no other nation, could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. So somewhere at the time of the end, and I'm going to speculate, in the next relatively few years, Iran is going to launch a blitzkrieg attack north, which brings it into southern Russia. West, the Hebrew is seaward, towards the sea. That will take it across Syria and into at least eastern Turkey. And, of course, it's going to go south, which brings it into Saudi Arabia. That will be a key place for Iran to go, because Saudi Arabia is where you get the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, and that's what Iran wants to get hold of. There are two horns representing two authorities. I've speculated. Get my little cowbell, ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling. Speculated that might be one of them, the supreme ruler, the Ayatollah. That's your top dog over there. And then the other one might well be what the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is it's a security operation, very powerful, out to defend the Ayatollahs, a notorious organization, heavily linked to terrorism. So they could be the two horns, potentially, but certainly Iran is going to go on the warpath, north and south and west. And nobody at that time in this this area of the prophecy can stand against it until verses 5 through 8. As I was considering, suddenly a male goat, or a he-goat, or a shaggy goat, came from the west. I guess that's now heading east. Came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, so very rapidly. And the goat had a notable horn, a very conspicuous horn between his eyes. The horn representing, again, an authority, a ruler, a king, a power source. Verse 6, he came to the ram, so launches an attack from the west, heading rapidly east until it butts into Iran, the ram, which had the two horns, which I'd seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. So here's Javan, I believe that's essentially modern-day Turkey, launching a massive and ferocious counterattack against Iran. That's going to be a big military battle with missiles, tanks, modern warfare and weaponry, pretty destructive. And don't forget, all of this is taking place around the area of the Persian Gulf, which, of course, is where the oil comes from, which is where most countries in the world, which they depend on for their own economies. So this will have, you know, worldwide repercussions, although the main fighting and battle is in the Middle Eastern area. Now, this is something we can watch out for and see if we see it building up. You know, today, both the ram and the he-goat are Islamic nations, Iran and Turkey. Iran is the Shia version of Islam. Turkey is mostly Sunni. They don't seem to like each other, particularly the Sunnis and the Shias. And Turkey, as a country, is massively important. It sits at the crossroads between Europe and Asia. If you're going from one to another, you pretty much have to go through Turkey. Here's a decent-sized population, about 80 million. The capital of Turkey is Ankara, although the largest and probably best-known city is Istanbul. Used to be called Constantinople, after Emperor Constantine of the Roman Empire. It has about 13 million people in Istanbul. It's a big city. We went there just after the feast last year. Very interesting visit. I think we all thoroughly enjoyed it. But the country has shifted somewhat since then in a rather ominous way. And Turkey, as of today, is probably the world's 8th, 9th, 10th most powerful military nation. It also has nuclear weapons, probably stationed there, courtesy of the US of A. Turkey, we said before, not only a major powerful nation today, but historically, Turkey was the old Ottoman Empire, an Islamic empire, the longest-lived Islamic empire, from about 1300 AD to only, quite recently, 1922. A very powerful, wealthy empire, which spread across the Middle East, across North Africa, into Saudi Arabia, in those days across Iran, and actually into Europe, right up into Austria at one point. So a very powerful major Islamic empire. And it does seem that its current president, Mr. Erdogan, who's a devout Muslim, who spent the last few years busy trying to move from a secular state to a much more Islamic religious state and is succeeding, it looks like he may have a vision of resurrecting the Ottoman Empire, restoring Turkey's greatness in Islam across much of the Middle East. We mentioned last week that a German weekly magazine, Der Spiegel, had an article, but in particular a front cover, showing Mr. Erdogan and one of the famous mosques there, where the minarets were being converted into, you know, missiles taking off. And the article says, you know, a nation losing its freedom. That's Turkey. And it referred to Mr. Erdogan as a dictator or a despot. Now, my wife managed to put a photograph of that cover from Der Spiegel into our notes last week. So if you scroll to the end of the notes that we put up, you'll find at the back of the article a picture of the Der Spiegel cover with Mr. Erdogan. It's quite an interesting caption. It does show missiles taking off from Turkey. I'm not sure where they're headed. I guess probably towards Iran. Also, in the same sort of place, we've got a couple of maps showing, they're not great maps, but the best I could find easily, showing Javan on these ancient Bible maps as hovering over the area of Asia Minor or Turkey. So you want to just check those out. Some recently have referred to Mr. Erdogan as being Hitler or Mussolini. So we watch Turkey. I'm watching Turkey. Also, if you think of Iran, now Iran is a Shia version of Islam. Its population is similar, about 81 million. It's not quite as powerful exactly as Turkey, but it does have ballistic missiles, tanks, and a virulent hatred of Saudi Arabia, where, of course, you find the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. Iran desperately wants to take over those holy cities to demonstrate its superiority as the descendants of Muhammad. And there's lots of saber rattling going on at the moment, coming out of Iran and between Iran and Saudi Arabia. They sort of seem to basically hate each other. Just 2 weeks ago, so this is, you know, pretty recent, the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia, that's the top religious man, said the Iranians are not Muslims. Right? The Iranians are not Muslims, but they are, quote, sons of the Magi, quote. Now, might not mean a lot to you and me, but that's quite provocative if you happen to be an Iranian, because what you're saying is that you're not Muslims at all. You Iranians, you don't worship Allah. You're sons of the Magi, meaning you're sons of Zoroastrianism, the old pagan religion of Persia, now known, of course, as Iran. So that's an insult. You're all apostates. Allah should wipe you out. So that's what the Saudis think of Iran. Of course, Iran's foreign minister then retorted and said that the toxic threat of, well, he used the term Wahhabism, W-A-H-H-A-B-I-S-M, that's a sort of a Saudi version of Islam, very strict version. He says the toxic threat of Wahhabism, that's Saudi Islam, cannot be ignored. Concrete action against extremism, namely the Saudis, is needed. So what you've got is right up to 2 weeks ago, and I'm sure it hasn't stopped, is lots of hostile rhetoric at present. But at some point, the nasty words are going to convert into action. And now that Mr. Obama has released somewhere between $30 billion and $150 billion to the Iranians, of which possibly $1.7 billion in used banknotes was actually handed across maybe to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, a terrorist organization, now Iran's got the money to buy more weapons, to fund more terrorism, and when they feel like it, to launch the attack of Daniel 8 verses 3 and 4. So I think we should watch the ram, watch the he-goat, watch Islam generally. You know, Islam, we said before, has a prime directive. Despite people referring to Islam as a religion of peace, that's not actually accurate. The Quran, which contains the words of Allah through the angel Gabriel, I believe, to Muhammad, says there that Islam must conquer the world. That's its prime directive, to conquer the whole world. And there are only three options. So it's quite simple to remember. Option one is you convert to Islam. That would be the recommended option. Option two is if you don't want to convert because you want to hang on to your, you know, Catholic, Protestant, Hindu, Buddhist, whatever ideas, then fine, you must accept being subjugated and humiliated and pay a tax. And by subjugation, they mean subjugation. You must feel every single day of your life that you are a humiliated person. Number three, if you don't want to convert to Islam, you don't want to accept being subjugated, then that's quite straightforward. You die. So it's not overly complicated, but that's the prime directive of Islam. Okay, now we're in the book of Daniel, so let's move on and look at some other beasts. Got a quite an important chapter, is Daniel chapter 7. So we're in Daniel 8. Let's flip back to Daniel 7, reading verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. So Daniel, not Nebuchadnezzar, has a dream. The dream comes in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Right, that's Babylon. That's the golden part of the statue. Now Belshazzar was the last king of Babylon. Right, been a few, but Belshazzar is the end of the road. Babylon as a kingdom is almost now over. Nebuchadnezzar's been dead for a while. Medo-Persia is about to appear on the scene and take over Babylon. The story of the writing on the wall, many, many Tekel Upharsin, all that carry on. Well, that's Belshazzar. His time is up. Okay, so the kingdom of Babylon, the head of gold, is almost over. The silver is about to arrive, namely the Medo-Persian Empire. Yet, look at Daniel 7:17. This is the vision, the prophetic vision that Daniel has just had. Verse 17 says, there's four beasts, which we'll get to in a moment, but of these four beasts, we're told, those great beasts which are four kings, or kingdoms, which arise out of the earth. Now, it's not quite so clear in my New King James there, but actually it's future tense. These are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. But actually, you couldn't say the kingdom of Babylon could, in the future, arise out of the earth, could you? Because it's just about over. You might have said that Persia is yet to arise, and Javan and the fourth empire, that would be, accurate. But to say these four beasts are four beasts which shall arise, if this is all historic, that doesn't make sense, because Babylon was almost over. Not going to arise, it's just about gone. Now, other translations make it very plain this is future. The King James says, these are four kings which shall arise. All four of them shall arise. Or the New American Standard Bible, four kings who will arise. The NET, four kings who will arise. So, in other words, the whole vision is yet for the future. Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar's day is not going to rise. It's finished, almost. So just like Daniel 8, with the ram and the he-goat, is yet future for the end time, Daniel 7 is pretty much the same. Okay, with that backdrop, let's read from verses 1 through 14 of Daniel 7. Again, we should know the narrative, that is to say, what the words are. We might want to leave open the exact perfect understanding of what they may mean, but we certainly should all know the words and know them reasonably well, so that as things happen around us, you think, you know what? That thing I've just seen in the news, I'm pretty sure that's what Daniel mentioned. Now, if we don't know what the prophets actually said, what the words are, then we won't be able to be properly watchful. So we should all be quite familiar with the words of prophecy. Okay, let's start verse 2. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. So four beasts, that's the key to Daniel 7, four beasts. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. A beast, a bit like a lion. Verse 5, and suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear. It was raised up on one side, had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and there was another, like a leopard, which had on his back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So one head on the lion, one head on the bear, four heads on the leopard, and then one more head on the other beast. So there are seven heads tucked away in these verses. Verse 7, after this I saw in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast. Not like any other animal. You got one like a lion and one like a bear and a leopard, but this one you can't find an animal to sort of describe it as. A fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous or arrogant words. Four beasts. What do these represent? I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow. The hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him, 10,000 times 10,000 before him. The court was seated, or judgment began, and the books were opened. A heavenly scene with the Ancient of Days. I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. That's the little fat horn out of the ten. I watched till the beast was slain, its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beasts, they're still around. They had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed, which is, of course, the kingdom of God and Jesus' return. So what this prophecy does is takes us from the lion and the bear and the leopard and the great terrible beast right up to Christ's return. So it's future. It's not all way back in the days of Alexander the Great and Belshazzar and so on. This prophecy takes us right up to the kingdom. Jesus' return. What's ahead of us? Now let's go back and just comment on two or three of these verses. Verse 4 refers to a lion. I think pretty much we understand that to relate to Babylon, but today we call Babylon Iraq. Okay, so here's a prophecy which we can at least for now just think of Iraq, Babylon. How about verse 5, the bear? Well, the bear represents Persia, but of course today we call that Iran. So, Iraq, Muslim country. And the bear, is Persia a Muslim or Islamic country? The leopard, well, fair enough. We know the third one was Javan or Yavan, with four heads. Well, of course, Turkey of today is an Islamic country. And then we got the fourth one, which of course is where all the debates usually start. The fourth one, verse 7, is a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and exceedingly strong. So a horrible, terrible beast. Traditionally, we'd say, oh, that's Rome. So you get an Islamic first beast, an Islamic second beast, an Islamic third beast, but the fourth one is Christian Rome. Not really fit. Don't really think so. And it has 10 horns mentioned there. And among the 10 horns, another horn, a little one, comes up. And this little horn speaks pompous words. Well, we'd say traditionally the Pope, because we're thinking of Rome. Well, I'm going to suggest that, consistent with what we saw in Daniel 2, that the fourth great and terrible empire is the Islamic Empire, and the little horn with the pompous words is in fact the Islamic Antichrist, their final leader. Because if you look at verse 7 again, notice halfway through it, it has huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. Well, breaking in pieces is the same word we've seen before for smashing and pulverizing. And again, Rome just did not do that. Okay, let's move down to verses 18 through 22. So we have the four beasts there. No current interpretation exactly, but the countries portrayed are Iraq and Iran and Javan, and I believe the Islamic Empire rather than the Roman Empire, but obviously you can have a view there if you wish. But notice verses 18 through 22. So now we're getting a bit of the interpretation. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So this is right up clearly at the end time. And we're not talking here about prophecy. Well, it's hardly prophecy, is it? If it's, whatever, 2,500 years ago, this is prophecy. It's for our time today. Verse 19. Then I wish to know the truth about, the fourth beast. Hey, Mr. Angel. This great and terrible beast, really curious, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron, its nails of bronze, which devoured, broke in pieces, and trampled the residue with its feet. This is an exceedingly destructive beast. You know, what is it? And about the 10 horns that were on its head, and about the other horn, which came up, before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. It's a big stout horn. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and, prevailing against the saints until the Ancient of Days came. So right up to the end time. Right up to Jesus' return, this pompous horn is still around. Still attacking and harassing and persecuting and, it would appear, killing the saints right up until the Ancient of Days came. Verse 22, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. End time, end time, end time, end time, obviously end time. That's why we should pay attention to these passages. They're not talking about old stuff. They're talking about what lies somewhere the next, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. Maybe a bit longer, maybe a bit less. Can't say for sure. If Iran launches its attacks later this year, then I guess it's going to happen in a hurry. Right? So the fourth beast wars against the saints, or at least the fat pompous horn does. Verses 23. Then he said, the angel is going to explain interpretation. Thank you, Mr. Angel. He says, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. Well, that, I think, is quite helpful. It's destructive. But notice it's different from all other kingdoms. I don't know what you might think, but would you say Rome was really different from Greece? Really different from Medo-Persia? Different language, you know, Latin versus Greek, but, you know, I suppose a more superior, you know, army. That's how they defeated the Greeks, but different? Don't know. But Islamic Empire, yeah, that's different, all right. And notice again, it tramples, verse 23, the last few words, break in pieces. That's the Hebrew word as a dekak, D-E-Q-A-Q, which is what we saw in Daniel 2, that the legs of iron will break in pieces, which means to shatter and to pulverize and to crush, which Rome didn't do. So I know I'm repeating myself, but Rome, I don't think it fits very well. Verse 24 and 5, the ten horns that you saw in this fourth terrible beast, the ten horns are ten kings or ten kingdoms, ten nations, and another shall arise after them, after them, that means ten, and after the ten comes another one, that's how I read the word after, I'll get back to it later. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings. So ten horns, then an 11th horn, so to speak, pops up, who subdues three of the ten. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, against God, shall, here we go again, persecute, the margin says wear out. You could use harass. He shall persecute, wear out, harass the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law, then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. So the saints are going to go through troublesome times because this stout horn, which has a lot of power, is going to harass the saints for a time and times and half a time. Now, historically, we'd say, well, this is the papacy, you know, the Vatican attacking people that won't keep Sundays. That's what we've sort of understood that to be. Or I will suggest this is more likely to be the Islamic Antichrist, that powerful end-time leader of the Islamic world, who will behead all those who won't worship Allah. Because anybody, even who bears the term Christian loosely, we might argue over whether they're a true Christian or not, etc. But if you say that you believe in God the Father, that Jesus Christ is his son, the Muslims will kill you. Because to them that is blasphemous. Allah is the only true God, and Allah does not have a son. So all people who bear the name Christian, whether it's, you know, really genuine or not, if they come to us Christian and say they believe in Jesus and God the Father, to the Islamic world, that is blasphemous and anathema. Now, it does say here in verse 25 also that this individual shall intend to change times and laws. Times and law. Again, traditionally, we've said, yeah, that's the Catholic Church. It's the Vatican. Because, you know, they sort of change the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. And the Ten Commandments, the law, you know, they fiddle with that too. You know, they sort of rather obscure or hid the one about not having a graven image because they've got them all over the place. So they sort of tucked that one away where you couldn't see it. And to make number 10 still 10, they divided the one about coveting into don't covet your neighbor's wife as one, then don't covet other things as 10. And so you still get 10, but really they've hidden one. Well, okay, that's the sort of, you know, view, but I would say an alternative view in terms of the Islamic approach is that we're talking here about changing the law to be changing to Sharia law. Sharia, law based upon the precepts of the Quran. And in any country where Muslims dominate, typically you're going to get Sharia law brought in. Interestingly, here in the UK, strange enough, 40% of Muslims, nearly half of all Muslims, would like Sharia law to be the law of the land. Oops. Sharia law, based on the Quran, affects banking, finance, economics, family life, marriage, criminal activity. It's thorough. And that's something that clearly a powerful Islamic antichrist individual would dearly want in all countries under his dominion, Sharia law. Then again, it says change times. Well, don't forget, in the Islamic world, Friday is the important day of the week. Friday is the day you worship on. And of course, if you made Friday the official day of worship, you could kiss goodbye to your traditional weekends. So, when Islam is in power, expect Sharia law, expect Fridays to dominate. Now, we read earlier about the 10 horns, the 10 kings of the great and terrible fourth beast. Traditionally, our view would have been that these represent 10 resurrections of the Roman Empire after 476 AD. If you want to check all that out, have a look at the Ambassador College Bible Correspondence Course lesson or the booklets, Who is the Beast, and so on. And so we've said that the 10 horns are 10 sort of successive. One comes after another, comes after another, comes after another, starting after 476 AD. We've said that the first three were rooted up by the Pope. That was the Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths. I'm sure you're very familiar with all those details, not going to belabor them. And that leaves seven more. So the first three are rooted up by the Vatican somehow. And then there's seven more to come, and they're spread over the period 554 AD up to the present time. 10 altogether. The ninth one was apparently Italy under Garibaldi or Mussolini or both. And the 10th one hasn't arrived yet. So the 10 horns, 10 sort of the coming one after another, but not actually successive. There were gaps between them, etc. And the last one was ended in 1945 with Mussolini's departure. And the 10th one isn't here yet. I don't think that fits. I don't think that fits the narrative. Because it says the pompous horn, who pulls up the first three, comes after the 10. Look at verse 24. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them and be different from the first ones, and shall subdue or subjugate three of them. So he comes after. So the view that the papacy pops up after the first three and seven more come after him, I don't think it fits. I think this is the Islamic antichrist, all-powerful leader who comes up after the 10 end-time nations of Islam. And early on, he has some sort of dispute and subjugates three of them, which for now I'll suggest are Egypt, Libya, and Sudan. Not going to get distracted by that, but we're talking here of 10 end-time Islamic nations combining together as a major empire across the Middle East with a powerful Islamic leader over them who decides, for reasons not clear at the moment, to subjugate three of them. Likely to be Egypt, Libya, and Sudan. You can see that in Daniel 11, verses 40 to 43, if you want to check that out. Right, before we leave Daniel 7, just notice verse 21. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints, and they were escaping from him. Oh, sorry, not quite right. And prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came. So the horn, either the papacy or the Islamic Antichrist individual, makes war against the saints and prevails. Are we ready? Verse 25. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute or harass or just wear down the saints of the Most High. And ending that verse, the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. That's 3.5 years. So this horn will persecute, harass, wear out, wear down the saints for 3.5 years. Now, Islam is doing that today. I don't think the papacy is particularly doing that at the moment or has done for quite a long time. But today, Islam is doing that. There are persecuted Christians. Anybody who bears the name Christ does not accept Allah and says, I'm a believer, I go to your church, I believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Anybody in an Islamic country that says that will be persecuted. There's severe oppression in many, many countries across the Middle East, across Africa, Indonesia. They burn churches. They kill Christians, whether real or so-called. Iran does it. Saudi Arabia does it. Iraq does it. Syria does it. They're among the worst, and it's happening right today. So once a all-powerful supreme leader arises with charisma and so on, that will multiply many times over. And anybody who bears the name Christian, whether genuine or nominal, makes no difference. They will either have to convert, be subjugated, and of course they'll do neither of those if they genuinely believe in Jesus, or in which case they will die. So the scriptural description we see here fits Islam. It's currently killing Christians. I think even Prince Charles said it's a great shame to see that the birthplace of Christianity, Christians are now, an endangered species. They're almost extinct in the Middle East. So once the abomination of desolation happens, the persecution, the harassment, the killing of the saints multiplies many times over. Look at Daniel 11, 31 to 35. So this is going to concern, people. People who bear the name Christ, they can see what's coming. Verse 31, I'm just going to show where the jump is. And forces shall be mustered by him, that's the king of the north, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, and they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation, which Jesus said, watch out for, and when you see it, if you're around, get out of here. Because the abomination of desolation, according to Jesus, there's a step change. Things turn nasty in a great hurry. Right? So we're talking here about how the pompous horn harasses and wears out the saints. This is what triggers the big increase in that. So the abomination of desolation is set up. Verse 32, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet, for many days, they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now this is the end time again. Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation, there'll be great tribulation. This is all end time, still end time. This is for us to look at and read. And it says that for many days, verse 33, they will fall by the sword. Well, how about beheading? By flame? Well, if you have any sort of Christian church anywhere in the Islamic countries, high risk of it being burned down, potentially with you in it. By captivity, well, I think we've seen that. And plundering or captivity could be, of course, just subjugation, humiliation, plundering. How about paying the jizya tax, taking over your business? But that happens wherever Islam comes in. Other religions eventually get plundered and taken over. Verse 34, now when they fall, because they are, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue or you know, devious. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purge them, and make them white until the time of the end. Because it is still for the appointed time. This is end time prophecy. All of it. So we have to watch out. Now let's look at what Jesus said there, just to tie it off. Matthew 24, because Jesus is referring to that passage, plus there's another couple of passages about the abomination of desolation in Daniel 9 and Daniel 12, but I'm not going there for now. Matthew 24 and verses 13 to 22. Jesus talking about the signs that would bring in his return. His disciples said, you know, what will be the sign of your coming and at the end of the age? Jesus said, look out for this, 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 and this. And here's one of them. Verse 13, he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, and then in brackets, Matthew's added, whoever reads, let him understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So when you see this, and you recognize, hey, this is what Daniel prophesied, I'm sufficiently familiar with Daniel's words to recognize this, which I now see, is what Daniel referred to, and I put two and two together. Once you see it, says Jesus, if you're in Judea, you know, the area of Palestine, modern-day Israel, flee to the mountains. Can you take your time? Well, let him who's on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Let him who's in the field not go back to get his clothes. You've got to be urgent. This is like priority. Go! But woe to those who are pregnant and those with nursing babies in those days. Pray your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath, for then, when's the then? When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, then there'll be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time. No, never shall be, and unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. So get out of town. This is Jesus' words of warning to his people somewhere ahead of us. And you wouldn't want to wait until you see the abominations. Think about, probably time to start praying to God now. Trying to start pleasing him. Trying to start looking at his word and becoming familiar with the prophecies. Bit late, chum. We need to be looking at the prophecies today, becoming familiar today, so that when these events happen, whether it's in 3 months' time, could be a year's time, 2 years' time, that we're already ready. Not wait till you see the abomination and the believers scampering off at a rate of knots and then say, oh, I think about getting my Bible out. Now, where did I last see it? I think it's in the room upstairs, is it? That's too late, Charlie. Today, we should be paying attention. Okay, let's move into the New Testament prophecies of the end time. Revelation 13 is a sort of a parallel to Daniel 7. So Revelation 13, and really, you can't understand Revelation 13 unless you understand Daniel 7, because they are covering pretty much the same territory. Revelation 13, and let's read verses 1 through 3. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, says John, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns. Well, the ten horns sounds familiar. And on his horns, ten crowns, on his heads, a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear. His mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as it had been mortally wounded, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marvelled and followed the beast. Now, okay, who is the beast? Well, there's actually a book, of course, entitled that. Yeah. Actually, there's quite a lot of books entitled that, and there are lots of ideas and views out there, but it's, I think most would sort of agree this beast is a composite of the Daniel chapter 7 beasts. There were four beasts there, remember? So this beast, verse 1, we have seven heads. Well, the beasts of Daniel 7 had, in total, seven heads. One for the lion, one for the bear, one for the great and terrible beast, and four on the leopard. Seven heads. It says in verse 1 here, ten horns. Well, fair enough, the fourth terrible beast had ten horns. Notice verse 2, it says, it was like a leopard, like a bear, like a lion. Well, again, the beasts of Daniel 7, one was a lion, one was a bear, one was a leopard. So it's, I think it's fairly well understood that this beast, this single beast here, is an amalgam, a combination, a composite of those beasts of Daniel 7. And Daniel, sorry, verse 3 here tells us this particular beast, or one of its heads, was mortally wounded, but then healed. Well, a couple of views. One, the traditional view that, I say we, it wouldn't just be us, view that the churches of God have held over a number of years, and I think other commentators and other traditional groups would say this is the Roman Empire. Well, we have to say that because that's consistent with the false understanding we've got of Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. So consistently, you're wrong. Well, I'm suggesting consistently you're consistent, but you're, when you make the wrong error about the Daniel 2 legs of iron and you compound that with the wrong conclusion about the terrible beast in Daniel 7, well, you end up, of course, with the wrong conclusion here. At least you're consistent, but you're consistently in error. So this is sort of the Roman Empire and its deadly wound, we are told, was 476 AD, as you all know. When Rome was overrun, not really sure about that, because actually the Roman Empire didn't stop for a moment. Roman Empire headquarters at that time were in Constantinople, far to the east. And the Roman Empire, if that's what we're talking about, didn't end until 1453. Anyway, so traditional view is this is the Roman Empire. The mortal wound was way back in 476 AD, and everything we read pretty much in Revelation 13 is actually all history. All long ago. It covers the centuries from 476 up till more or less now, but pretty much this passage is historical. No great relevance to you and me, not from a practical perspective. You know, we should know it, but it's really all past. The alternative view is that Revelation 13 is for today. The prophecy is for today. And this is talking of the completely destructive end time Islamic Empire. The deadly wound, I will suggest, is possibly 1922 through 24. So less than one century ago. That's when the Ottoman Empire, this massive empire, this glorious Islamic empire that ran for 600 years came to an end. And in 1924, the caliphate, the position of caliph or caliph, top man, was disbanded. That's a mortal wound. The end of the Islamic empire in any glorious way, and the end of the caliphs. Oh, the last of the caliphs. These are the supreme leaders of Islam. The caliph is the top man. He has complete authority, religiously and politically. There is none today. I think they're looking for one to come back. But in 1924, they formally ended the caliphate and the empire. That looks like potentially a deadly wound. But notice the deadly wound is to be healed. Very soon? Think so. Because President Erdogan wants to restore, it seems, the Ottoman Empire. And today the Islamic nations are looking for and waiting for their caliph to arrive. The man with supreme authority to help the Muslims establish Allah's reign over the whole world. So I think this deadly wound is shortly to be healed. We might see it in the next year or two or three. Verse 4. So they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast who is able to make war with him? This powerful end-time Islamic empire made up of 10 horns or 10 individual Islamic nations combining the forces together, right? Who can make war when you add up all the military weaponry? And notice that it's the dragon who gives authority to this empire. Well, the dragon is Satan, we all know that. But actually, I'll say that Allah is Satan. You know, some people say that, you know, Muslims worship the same God as Christians. No, they don't. No, they don't. The God I worship, I call Father, our Father, who art in heaven. And he has a son, Jesus, the Messiah. Muslims don't worship such a God. Allah is not such a God. And, of course, Islam and jihadis, they war and kill in the name of Allah, don't they? They shout, Allahu Akbar, which means Allah is greater when they go into battle. I mean, it's actually a common day-to-day phrase that many, many Muslims use, you know, day in, day out. But whenever you hear of a bomb attack or a knife attack or a gun attack carried out by some Islamic jihadis, you'll always hear the reference to, yeah, as they rush forward, they shouted, Allahu Akbar, Allah is greater. Well, yeah, that's verse 4. Verse 5, and he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and was given authority to continue for 42 months. 42 months? Well, and that's 3.5 years, I reckon. But potentially, traditionally, the view we would have taken is that 42 months, we'll say, well, you know what? 42 months is actually 42 prophetic months, which means 1,260 years. And Church of God would say that relates to the period from, as you know, because you're all, I've got great memories, relates to the period of 554 AD. When Emperor Justinian knelt before the Pope to be crowned, up until 1814, when Napoleon ended and fell. So it's history, isn't it? You know, the 42 months is telling us what happened between 554 AD and 1814 at the time of Napoleon? Really? I don't think that's convincing. I'll read this as actually, this is 42 months, 3.5 years. Remember in Daniel 7, we read of the time, times and half a time, that the pompous horn harassed and wore out the saints. This is it, same period. It's the end time, 3.5 year period, when the Islamic Empire is at its apex, when its powerful leader, its charismatic end time caliph, is busy harassing and killing believers of all sorts. Verse 6, and he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, those who dwell on earth, in heaven, sorry, and it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given to him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. So he overcomes the saints. We read that in Daniel 7, 21 and 25. It lasts 3.5 years. Once the abomination of desolation is put in place, won't get distracted too much, but you may recollect in Daniel 9 there's reference to a covenant of 1 week or 7 years, and halfway through that, the covenant is broken, the abomination of desolation is set up, and that triggers the Great Tribulation. That triggers this 42 months harassment of the saints. Verses 8 through 10, and all who dwell on the earth will worship this beast, this Islamic empire, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. So here's the first beast of Revelation 13. It's a composite of the beasts of Daniel 7, and I will say it is the end time Islamic empire of 10 nations, 10 Islamic nations, and it makes war. Now there's one more beast, second beast of Revelation 13. Might just race through this briefly and pick it up a bit perhaps next week, but let's read verses 11 through 18 quickly. Then I saw another beast, a second beast, coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. I think it's not yet healed, but perhaps soon. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. He deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause... as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Well, there we go again. If you don't worship this Islamic empire and Allah, you will be either convert, be subjugated, or looks like the more popular outcome is to kill you. And he causes all, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who is understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it's the number of a man, and his number is 666. Here's the second beast of Revelation 13. Two horns like a lamb, speaks like a dragon. Who is this beast? Well, there's at least three options. You can pay your money, take your choice. The first, very popular belief, if you're a Seventh-day Adventist, is that the second beast here is the United States of America. Boo, hiss, all you Yanks. Well, there are quite a few Seventh-day Adventists. Obviously, there are Sabbath keepers. I believe there are currently about 20 million Sabbath-keeping Adventists on the earth. Quite big numbers, growing quite rapidly. Seems to be quite a popular church at the moment. But they believe this beast is the United States of America, which is soon going to enforce Sunday worship in America and enforce it. And I think, presumably, deal with the Adventists and other Sabbath keepers. That's one view. I don't think it's the correct view. The more traditional view that you and I would have grown up with is that this is the papacy. That the second beast, who looks like a lamb, you know, the Pope looks like a nice guy, but actually the dragon is behind him. And the two horns represent two levels of authority. One is religious authority, because obviously the papacy, the Vatican, is over, you know, 1 billion Roman Catholics. Spiritually, of course, most don't pay much attention to the Pope. And secondly, there's some sort of political power with the Vatican, because it is a state, a city-state, Vatican City. It has ambassadors to many countries, so the two horns represent spiritual authority and sort of, you know, some sort of civil political authority. That's a view, one that we should be familiar with. I think it's wrong. And the third alternative, I'm going to say, is that in keeping with what we've seen so far, this beast is the Islamic Antichrist, the final caliph, the one who has complete, total authority, religious and political, over the first beast. That's the empire of 10 Islamic nations. Right? So we're talking here about the end time individual with a charisma and power who becomes the head of the Islamic world. And if we look a little bit further down here, verse 14, he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. So make an image to the Islamic Empire. What could that be? Well, the word image in Greek is an icon. When you spell it E-I-K-O-N, icon, it means likeness. So this individual says he wants a likeness to be made of the Islamic Empire. And quite likely this means he will force all countries, of which he has any authority at all, to adopt Sharia law and model their societies, their countries, on Islamic law and probably the calendar as well. Wants to change times and law. So that would be the image or the likeness of Islam, which if they don't do it, action is taken to make them do it or wipe them out. Potentially it could be, you know, a physical image, a statue, potentially. Not sure, you have to speculate a wee bit here, that seems a little bit unlikely. But notice verses 16 and 17. Verse 15, he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and, notice, cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark, the mark of the beast, on their right hand or forehead, and that no one can buy or sell except one who has the mark. So if you don't get the mark on your hand or forehead, you can't trade. You can't go to the supermarket. You can't hold down a job. You can't run a business. You can't buy and sell. You can't look after your family. Unless you get the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So it sounds like it's going to be pretty grim if you're under the authority of this individual. You haven't got those things, you know, you are going to be in serious trouble. On the other hand, if you accept the mark of the beast, you're going to be in even bigger trouble. Because look at, finally, at Revelation 14, 9 through 12. We'll cover this again next week. If you accept the mark of the beast in order that you can buy and sell and trade and look after your family and pay your mortgage, notice, then a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and his image and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation, with no diluting. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. So if any of us were to receive this mark, we receive God's undiluted wrath. So clearly, God thinks this is a very bad idea. If you don't take it, you won't be able to buy or sell or live. What a choice. Well, okay, I think we're out of time for tonight, so we'll pick up that story when we come together next week. So that'll do us for today.